So, first the entertainment.
There's a theme here.
Love is a burning thing.
For the Foreigners, this is a very famous country western singer.
A fiery ring.
The late good Johnny Cash.
Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring.
This brings me back to my youth.
I went down, down, down.
So the question is, did Johnny Cash coin the term, or did tectonophysicists coin the term? And I don't know the answer to that question at present. I did some work on that this week and did not find the answer. I do too. So I want to go through just sort of briefly on the way the Earth works in a very simple manner, the kind of description you'd use for undergraduates or even for your children. And then we'll come down to laboratory earthquakes and something called dynamic earthquake triggering. Before I do that, bear with me for just a moment. Okay. Okay, let's go back. All is well. Okay. So this work has grown over the last 10 years or so in collaboration with many people. A few of them are listed here. And a number of these people attended the conference this week. The outline for my presentation is I want to talk about earthquakes simply. That's what I said a moment ago. And then talk about fault gouge as a granular material. That'll actually be after I briefly describe something called dynamic earthquake triggering. And then we'll go into the laboratory studies. And if there's time, I'll show you a bit of the discrete element modeling associated with the work. This is just a very cool movie about how the whole system works. So let's take a look at it. So this is something you can find from the Geodharma, as he's called, on YouTube. But it's convection driving the Earth's plates. So here we've got the forcing function. We can see the creation of the Earth's crust that's pushed out by the convection cells. The subduction process, and ultimately everything else that goes along with it, all the other kinds of faulting one observes, and then eventually, at the end of this presentation, how volcanoes are formed, which I think is coming now. I'll just take you to the end of this short movie, and then we'll go on. That is very cool. So you can find that. Look for the Geodharma online if you want to show your children how convection works. So there are many, many types of faulting. The kind that I want to focus on today, because it's analogous to what we're doing in the laboratory, is a strike-slip kind of fault or transform fault, as the San Andreas fault is. This is an aerial view. And this is just another animation of how the whole thing works. That's how it breaks. You have a buildup in friction. Eventually, the stresses overcome the frictional coefficient. You have Coulomb failure or something like that. Maybe it's more complicated than Coulomb. This is a great slide that is modified and stolen from Yehuda Ben-Zion, who's in the audience. And what you have here on top is a fault zone, and this is based on a lot of field work that Yehuda and his colleagues have done, where you have very specific structures associated with this kind of faulting. But the part I want to get to is the inside of the fault. So we zoom in here, and we see this very complicated structure that contains at its core material that's been ground up or commutated over time because of the stick slip process in the fault zone. And if you look at a blow up, I can't remember the scale of this, and I took this from Karen Mayer, who's in Oslo, you can see this highly granular material that's contained in the fault gouge. I can't remember what the scale is here, but I think it's several centimeters. So this is the material we think is really important in terms of the process I'm going to describe today. This is another slide I stole from Yehuda, just because it's one of the coolest slides I've seen in terms of superficial expression of faults beside the San Andreas fault. This is rupture along the Gobi at Altai fault in Mongolia, and you can see the fault trace extremely well. So I want to show you yet another animation. This is actually a simulation of Southern California and from the Southern California Earthquake Center. This is SCEC, who is this organization. This is a terrific public service organization, both to science and to the public in terms of understanding and characterizing earthquakes with a goal, partial goal of predicting earthquakes. But let's look at how complex rupture is along the San Andreas Fault based on this model. So we see the initiation here. These are waves propagating away. The rupture front is moving this direction of fault. You can see the waves as they traverse into the low velocity sediments in the LA Basin, this strong amplification of these waves. Look at the waves heading towards Santa Barbara. Strong amplification just south of Santa Barbara and near Oxnard. And the long-lasting effects, sort of resonant standing wave type effects that you get in these low velocity sediments for reasons I won't go into. But if you have low velocity material, you tend to trap energy, as you probably know, and that's what's going on here. Again, you can find this online. Work's been done for me and for you. So let's move on to the primary topic that I want to address, and that is the phenomenon of dynamic earthquake triggering. So first of all, let's just kind of walk through what this is, what this phenomena is, and then we'll explore this phenomenon in the laboratory. First of all, you have triggering of other earthquakes from an earthquake in the near region of an earthquake. These are known as the aftershocks that you're probably all familiar with. You have a large earthquake, you have a sequence of earthquakes that follow this sort of cascading effect, and these are called aftershocks. These are triggered by dynamic stress changes, but also by dynamic waves in the system. And it's hard to distinguish what percentage might be dynamically triggered and what might be quasi-statically triggered. That's a point of great debate amongst people interested in this problem. So the very interesting thing that takes place is as waves propagate away from this earthquake source, you can produce triggering at large distances, hundreds and even thousands of kilometers away from the original source, which is pretty astonishing. The wave strains and displacements are minuscule at these distances, yet you can push a system to failure with a very small dynamic perturbation. Let's just look at a sequence in the near field of aftershocks. Again, these would be quasi-statically and dynamically triggered. This is the Christchurch earthquake that caused the second one, which caused so much damage in Christchurch, New Zealand. The main shock was the big red spot. So these are the aftershocks. And at large distance, then you have the same effect due to dynamic effects only. Here in the near field, as I say, you can't distinguish whether it's quasi-statically triggered or dynamically triggered in general. So in 1992, there was a very well-known earthquake known as the Landers earthquake, magnitude 7.2, Southern California. And Dave Hill and colleagues, a large number of colleagues, observed after this earthquake, as seismic waves swept across the western U.S., the western U.S. lit up with seismicity all the way up to through Yellowstone, Montana. And so for the first time, there was this convincing argument that indeed this effect of dynamic earthquake triggering took place. So this was viewed as a curiosity initially. And I think some people disbelieved it, even though there was pretty strong proof, because you could see it in terms of the earthquake rates before and after. But as time went by through the 90s, more and more earthquakes exhibited the same behavior. So now it's accepted that this is a fairly common phenomenon that takes place for many, if not all, largest and large earthquakes. So the idea in cartoon form is this, that you have a fault, and that fault has to be in a particularly a special condition. The fault has to be in a critical stress state already near failure. And I'll show you what that means from laboratory studies soon. But you can imagine that if that fault is already in a state near failure, that it may be that a small perturbation can kick the system to failure. And that's what happens. Generally, it's the surface waves, that's meant to be a surface waves, that do the job. These are large amplitude waves. They have less loss because they're traveling across the Earth's surface than body waves, compressional and shear waves. But compressional and shear waves also do trigger earthquakes. So conditions of a system ripe for failure, key, fairly large strain amplitudes in the waves is the other sort of key component. Another very interesting part of this is you can have instantaneous failure, but more often than not, the failure is delayed. And it can be delayed for minutes, seconds, minutes, hours, days, months, and some would argue years. So frequently, you have a system that you've perturbed, you've put it into some sort of metastable state, and eventually it goes. But it goes sooner than it would have gone. That's the idea. So in our work in the laboratory, we started looking at this problem. Zhaoping Jia, who's in the room, and I started thinking about this problem about almost 10 years ago, trying to understand what was happening, because it's quite a mystery. There are many hypotheses about how this happens. So we threw ourselves into the mix. And based on experiments that both Zhaoping and I did in Paris, and then eventually work that Chris Moran and I have done at Penn State University, we discovered that the granular gouge was incredibly important for this triggering process, meaning whenever we conducted the kind of experiments I'm going to show you in a moment, we could never trigger the system unless we had granular material in between the plates. And we've tested that in a number of other systems, and we've done many experiments to convince ourselves that is the case. However, at large enough wave amplitudes, if you're in a critical state near failure, you're going to fail. But at wave amplitudes that are associated with seismic waves, we're unable to trigger. So as a result, we believe the granular gouge is fundamental. And that is the reason we explore the granular physics in detail. So we are currently working in studying field data, laboratory data in Chris Marone's lab, and numerical simulation at ETH with colleagues run by the group of Jan Carmelite. So let's look at some 3D slip experiments. This is the apparatus. It's a biaxial apparatus. It's about a meter by a meter. You apply to a sample here a fixed load. And, well, let's just look at the animation. This is the sample holder. You have two gouge layers here. You apply a fixed load to the system. Then you drive the central block down at, in our case, in general, constant displacement rate. And as this block moves downward, once you reach steady state, you see this very consistent stick-slip behavior that allows you to study the statistics of the process and to perturb the system to see, because it's so consistent in the behavior, you can perturb the system and see very small fluctuations. And I should say that we drive this system with a piezo ceramic so that we can apply a sound wave to the system, a proxy for a seismic wave perturbing a fault zone. We record with an accelerometer to look at the acoustic emission coming out of the system. So here's an example for a single experiment run in Chris's lab. This is experimental runtime, and this is shear stress in blue. You can see this forest of vertical lines. Each one represents a shear stress drop or a stick slip event, an earthquake in the laboratory. If you zoom in on two of those events, you'll see something like this. And you can see that you have a stress drop, a recovery, and another stress drop. I'll go into the details of that in a moment. The other interesting thing is that in red, the red dots show you that you have very large or relatively large acoustic emission associated with each stick slip event. And you have many, many, many small events associated with the faulting process in the laboratory as well. We'll see more details about these soon, but there are two distinct populations. The amplitudes, the wave amplitudes associated with the stick slip event are much, much larger than for these very small events, which are precursor events. So let's look at some of the characteristics coming out of the experiment as we shear. This is, I'm showing a number of parameters here, acoustic emission, slip, and friction. So this is the same curve I just showed you in terms of the shear stress. So that's a single slip event. What's interesting here is that if you look at the slip of that central block that we're pushing down, at slip time, you see it jerks forward, and then it arrests. It just stops. Say hello from me, Jan. The block stops, and then it begins to move again in this region. The material begins to dilate. And as you approach, as you start to approach failure, you start to see acoustic emission, these dots. At the same time, at the time of slip, you see a thinning of the granular material. So it compresses, and then it's at rest. Then it begins to dilate during as the block begins to move forward. We call this the period of dilation and silent slip, silent because there are no acoustic emission associated with it, till you reach this critical state, and then the system fails again. So I guess that's all I wanted to say about this. Yeah, let's move on. Here's another experiment, not necessarily the one I showed you a few slides back. This again is shear stress versus time. And there's a zoom that's associated with this region in blue. And I just wanted to show you what the, this is again shear stress versus time for the zoom. And I wanted to show you that the acoustic emission are very particular in terms of where they're located, in terms of the stress cycle. They occur just before failure in this critical state. And that's the only time they occur in this system. We're going to come back to those acoustic emission and look at these B values, the scaling of magnitudes, in a bit, or maybe right now, in fact. So this is occurrence versus magnitude. Our laboratory magnitudes are tiny. We're looking at a range of negative 19.5 to minus 16.5, in contrast to negative 2 to 9 in the Earth. And what you see here is those precursor events I just showed you are here. And then the stick-slip events are here. These are the characteristic events of the stick-slips. Bob showed you very similar behavior in the 2D system in his talk earlier in the week, Bob Ecke. This is just the same plot. We're just zooming in on the small amplitude AE. The slope is about minus 1.7. As you've seen over and over again, and Jan's talk as well, global average is 1, but it's highly variable across the globe depending on region you look at. But I think the comforting thing to us was that we were close to 1. It could have been anything, but the fact that we were near 1, negative 1, was very comforting that maybe our experiment has something to do with characteristics, physical characteristics in the Earth. If you look at the laboratory, Bob Ecke's data here, 2D, our 3D data, mine at magnitudes of minus 5 to 1, whole Earth for magnitude 6, I think, and above. Yeah, magnitude 5.5 and above. We're all around 1. So let's talk about triggering. Those are the calculated magnitudes from the dynamic wave. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's the B value. So I don't have much time here. So I started a little late. Can I have just an extra? Okay. So here again is shear stress as a function of time. And here we're perturbing the system with a dynamic wave. So at 1, 2, and 3, we've hit the system with a very brief duration dynamic wave. And we can see we've really perturbed the system, and it lasts a long time. In fact, this is an envelope of one of those perturbations. So it's the envelope of the shear stress. And you can see the decrease in shear stress and the long recovery. This is the inter-event time, the time between the stick-slip events. So you can see that the inter-event time is fairly consistent. We apply the sound wave, or tapping event, whatever you want to call it. We have a decrease in this inter-event time, or recurrence. And then it slowly goes back to its original state. So we're in this metastable state for some period of time here through many, many, about 15 or 20 stress cycles, which we initially found incredibly surprising. We expected a reset of the system with the next stick slip event. That did not happen. So we have this very long-lived phenomenon through many violent stick slip cycles from this modest acoustical perturbation. You have a change in thickness that's longer lived than the effect on recurrence and shear stress. So again, the material thins and then dilates. But that dilation lasts through tens of stick slip cycles. This is just recovery characteristics of the shear stress. Let's go on since we're running short of time. So we applied individual triggers or tapping events to the system, only 3 for a full experiment, which lasts several hours. In the previous one here, we hit it with sound frequently. So here's shear stress versus time again. We zoom in here and we look at a system where we applied no vibration. So these are the stick slip, this is shear stress again with no vibration, and here is with vibration. You can see they look different. There's inconsistent stick slip behavior. And if you look more carefully at that, what you find is if you plot this inter-event time, a recurrence interval, for a non-vibration experiment, it's between the dashed lines, this gray region. For a vibrational experiment, you can see we get more and more deviation in this inter-event time as a function of the experiment. So we really perturb the system, and it stays perturbed. If we look at the stress drop, the shear stress drop, as a function of this inter-event time, we can see we have distinct populations between the vibration experiment and the non-vibration experiment. This would also be true of looking at thickness and some of the other parameters we measure. Let's look at another type of behavior. If we now drop the load to a smaller load level, remember we apply a horizontal load to this three-block system. If we drop the load in half compared to the experiments I just showed you, we see quite different behavior. In this region, we have essentially stable sliding. There are very, very few stick slip events. So the stable sliding corresponds to the critical state. So as you slide, you apply sound. And what happens is the shear stress drops, but it drops slowly over several seconds. So it's not a stick slip event. It's a slow slip event. And as long as the wave is in the system, this is actually the tone burst wave we're using for about 5 seconds. As long as it's in there, the shear stress stays low. We stop applying the sound, and we see this recovery process again. So it looks quite similar if you fit the previous experiment with low pass filtered it, you would see a behavior like this. So they're very similar characteristics, except here we're just softening the system. Simultaneously, we're thinning the system, which is counterintuitive. So, and this is essentially acoustical fluidization. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? Okay, good. So I just want to show you a few characteristics associated with this slow slip or fluidization. If we look at the shear stress, this is for a stick slip event. Here we're applying larger and larger amplitude waves to the system. You can see there's an amplitude dependence. So the larger the amplitude we apply, the larger the shear stress drop. If we look at the change in thickness, we can see it's the same. It thins more and more and more each time we apply progressively apply larger amplitudes to the system. And this is the acoustic emission associated with it. There's also a larger slip event of that central block, a displacement of that central block as amplitude increases. So we're looking at a nonlinear effect. So I want to come back to an experiment that Jim Langer talked about earlier this week, just very briefly, and compare it to the experiments you just saw and to another experiment. So this was the experiment. It's a rheometer. So you place a disc on a group of glass beads or angular beads. You turn it. That's the rheometer here. And you're either using glass beads or, as I said, angular sand in this case. And in the case of the, this is the angular sand, for no vibration versus vibration applied, this is the thickness of this unit versus the shearing rate of this unit. And in this region, you're sort of quasi-static behavior. Here you're transitional, and this is inertial. This is in a really nice paper by Nick van der Elst et al. That came out in JGR 2 years ago. So, and this is the case for glass beads. The point I want to make here is that this behavior, we believe, this decrease in thickness is due to exactly the same process as I just described, only the sound is internally generated by the grain collisions. That's what we believe. So you have this nonlinear induced effect from collisions. It's an auto acoustical compaction. Now, if you look at a glass bead pack that you're not shearing, so this is an experiment that Xiaoping Jia, who's in the audience, and I conducted a few years ago, and you apply sound to a glass bead pack at larger and larger amplitude, and you follow the modulus, this is the normalized modulus, as a function of the wave amplitude, you see that the sound speed decreases. At the same time, Xiaoping showed you, if you saw his talk, that the thickness can decrease as well. Very similar to what we see in the shearing experiments. If you go to larger and larger applied pressure to the system, which you apply here, you can see the effect is diminished, but it still exists up to some limit where you turn off the effect. And moreover, after it's over, after you've finished applying the sound, you can see that there's a recovery process depending on the wave amplitude you applied here and the pressure you applied that lasts over a long period of time. This is lapse time from 100 to 10,000 seconds. This is typical of what one sees when you apply sound waves to a glass bead pack, and it's highly reminiscent of what we see under shear conditions as well. So we believe that this plays a fundamental role in this destabilization process when you trigger, especially for the delayed triggering. One would argue for instantaneous triggering that it's probably just Coulomb failure. But for these delayed failure events, which we see in the laboratory and one sees in Earth, it's certainly in the laboratory and may in the Earth potentially be related to destabilization of the granular material and eventual failure. So, should I wrap it up? Two minutes? Okay. So our colleagues at ETH are doing discrete element modeling of this system. It's not a two-block system, it's a single-block system. So we have a shearing block here, a granular layer here, and another shearing layer here, and there's roughness here and here. And the nice thing about the experiment, the simulation, is because our experiment is opaque, we have the ability now to look into the system and try to understand, unravel what the grain characteristics are. This is friction coefficient. So in this case, the shear stress over the normal load in a simulation. You can see a stress drop here, or a friction drop, and a recovery, similar to what we see in the experiment. We can see at the time of the slip event that we have a big increase in the kinetic energy. Bob Ecke showed you this too in the 2D experiments, very similar behaviors. So whatever metric you use that follows grain mobility shows you that there's a large increase in that mobility at the time of a stress event. One also sees these acoustic emission preceding slip. I won't go into that. This is about the last thing I'm going to show you, that if you apply a triggering pulse, you can see that here, it's a Gaussian shape wave to the system, and you look at the friction coefficient. In a non-vibrated system, you see the black line. In a vibrated system, you see the blue lines, and as a function of amplitude, you see this progressive increase in the time of failure. In seismology, you would call this a clock advance, related to the timing of the event. This is the kinetic energy, again, associated with these slip events. A simulation B value here of 1.23, similar to what we're seeing in the laboratory, mine, and whole Earth. This is conceptually, I think, what we see across these systems is that you're measuring some elastic characteristic. It could be change in the intervent time, it could be change in thickness, it could be change in the velocity of the material. You apply a perturbation to the system, there's a change. While that wave is in the system, when the wave dies down, you have this long recovery process back to equilibrium or to a new equilibrium condition. So in summary, earthquakes trigger earthquakes. I showed you that based on Earth observations, seismic observations, and a little bit of that in laboratory in a qualitative manner. We believe, based on a lot of work we've done, that granular physics is really key to the triggering in the laboratory. I showed you examples of why we think that, or some evidence for why we think that. And the mechanism of triggering in laboratory is due to granular elastic nonlinear dynamics, in most cases, we would say. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yeah. So one comment is that the underdamped model that we looked at, which produces the much larger earthquakes and the tail, was designed in part because it has triggering by these seismic waves, and they're very important in giving us large, more delocalized events that happen in different places. But then the question is, how big is the amplitude of the acoustic wave? If I were to try to estimate the kind of forces they would generate between grains, how would that compare to the normal load in your system?
They're much smaller than the normal load.
By how many?
I'm not going to give you, I can give you strain and I can give you modulus and you can calculate the stress. The modulus are on the order of several gigapascal and the strain amplitudes are 10 to the minus 6 roughly. So you can do the math. But the applied loads in our system are 1 to 10 megapascal. So we're talking about several kilopascal in comparison to a megapascal minimum of load applied to the system, okay? Does that help?
Yeah. Question? Yeah. Yeah, nice presentation. Especially I like your music.
I do too.
In your plot, if you look at the shear stress versus time, can you go to the plot, please?
For one of the experiments,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, with the acoustic emission.
With acoustic, oh, let's
yeah,
go to that.
Yeah, two or three slides right. back, I think.
Yeah, here's one.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Now, if you look at the curve carefully, on the right-hand side, looks like within one serration, there's some minute vibration there. Is that significant or there's a noise?
You mean all of this stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, that is primarily electromagnetic noise in our system, our recording system. Okay, we're not during these group of experiments. We weren't very well shielded from electromagnetic noise, and that's primarily what you're seeing. However, there's a mix though. I mean, for instance, you see these pieces which exhibit no acoustic emission. But there are very small stress drops associated with all those acoustic emission. So you can see those up in here. If you squint your eye, you can see some variations in the shear stress, and those are the small stress drops that produce the acoustic emission. So there's two different things going on here. One's physical to the experiment, and one is not.
So then can you say what's going on in the small drops?
Yeah. We measure a very small stress drop associated with those. So we're seeing very small lab quakes preceding the major quake.
I see.
Okay, so they're true precursors of the major slip event.
Thank you.
Thanks. Paul, I just wanted, you really had a magnitude scale for experiments, right? So you said magnitude 90 and it's 18 minus 9. So how exactly did you get that? Because people typically struggle with associating real magnitudes.
Yeah, I mean, I hope nobody would ask that.
Sorry, Paul.
So since we have the distance is fixed, so we just calculate a magnitude from the amplitude. We measure acceleration, and we can calculate velocity, particle velocity, or displacement, or strain. So from that, we go directly to magnitude. So it's not moment magnitude; it's magnitude.
So that could affect the exponent you see as well, because the quantity.
I'm sorry.
That could affect the exponent you see, right? You had minus 1.7.
Yeah,
if it's
yeah,
a slightly different.
Yeah,
quantity.
But it could be slightly different, but maybe a factor of 2, not 10.
So you think it's proportional?
Yeah.
What's the current explanation of deep focus earthquakes, where probably granular systems would be fully jammed like this?
Do you mean earthquakes that are 600 kilometers? Oh, ask Yehuda. Yehuda, are you here? He just left. Honestly, I don't know, but Let's rephrase the question because it's very interesting, the point you bring up. You might expect that at nucleation depths, seismogenic nucleation depths of 10 to 15 to 20 kilometers, everything would be under such high hydrostatic pressure that all these effects would be turned off. Nonetheless, you trigger those systems. And it turns out that you can have very high fluid pressures, especially in zones where you have a lot of fracture and fluids can migrate. So the hypothesis is that you're at very low effective pressure, which is the overburden minus the pore pressure. And if that effective pressure is low enough, then these effects could take place. And this kind of phenomenology we're talking about could take place. If not, we need to appeal to something else. But it's reasonable because we know faults are filled with fluids. So you could imagine that at 600 kilometers, I don't think anything at 600 kilometers triggers, by the way, not to my knowledge. So, but at 600 kilometers, I don't know what the hell's going on. Phase transition or what? There are people that know a lot about that, and I know nothing about that.
A question? I had one quick question. I think you mentioned it, but I missed it. Do you have aftershocks in the experiment?
No.
Okay.
And the reason we have, as you saw, we have foreshocks, but we don't have aftershocks. In a fault zone, most of the aftershocks take place off the fault zone, and we have a single fault zone. So, so I think that's the explanation for the difference between our system and an actual fault.
Any last questions? If not, then we'll have now the coffee break till 4 o'clock, so we have half an hour. Let's think.
Thank you.